This episode is supported by Pop M, a unique shop located in Littleton, New Hampshire, and by ICE, the Institute of Culinary Education.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview someone who I admire in the world of food and hospitality. And this week, I have the most extraordinary guest who's here all the way from Ghana. She actually grew up in Westchester, which, as you might know, is just a little bit north of New York City. But after going to Dartmouth and then spending time, 10 years, actually, that's a lot of time, traveling with the UN, she has made a choice to be a big part of the food world and influence the food of her country, Ghana, and she has a pop-up. So without further ado, I'm incredibly excited to have Selassie Atadika. You can see how hard it would be for me to learn foreign languages, because it's just not, doesn't land with me. Anyway, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you grew up till you were age six in Ghana, and then you came to the U.S. What was it like to, you know, have that change at such a young age, and what propelled you to move from Ghana to the States?
I think I was young enough to kind of go with the flow, but there was a political unrest in my home country of Ghana, and my family had to leave. And so we found our way to the U.S. and I would say that's the short version of the story.
I'm sure it's quite a bit longer than that. Was it, did you have a sense of anxiety of leaving what you knew behind and coming to this place that was completely unknown? Or were you in such a family bubble, you're just happy to be together?
I think it was a family bubble. I mean, when we left, I think we didn't really know. We were kind of going on an adventure and, you know, like excited to get on the plane and fly somewhere. And we weren't, you know, sure exactly where we were going. But we ended up in New York.
and when you were in New York, you went to grade school here.
Yeah.
And were people embracing of your difference in the culture that you came from?
I would say it's mixed. I mean, there was always a lot of teasing that happens when you're a kid. And there's also misunderstandings. I mean, it's interesting now that I have friends that are also African that have moved to the U.S. when they were growing up, and we were always like, did you get that same question too? The questions were always like, did you have a pet lion? Did you live in a treehouse? Did you, you know, so I mean, there's all
really
these.
Is that really true? I mean, people
No,
really,
those were the questions, and it's amazing because literally with a lot of my other friends that are African that moved here, it's like, did you also got that question? We're like, what's going on in American TV? And like, you know, and so there are all these, you know, preconceived notions, and so yeah. So it's really interesting. So there's I would say that there was a little bit of teasing from some people, but more of it would be a lack of understanding or even conceptualization of it.
I love do you do a lot of themed dinners?
I try to.
Yeah.
So I mean the sardines, it was the fresh sardines. Okay, the canned sardines are normally eaten with something called gari.
Uh-huh.
Gari is a dried cassava. It's cassava that's been grated and dried and sometimes fermented. And it's something that parents also send with their kids. And so you just add hot water and then it creates something called eba, which is just like a starch that you eat with the sardines. So what I did was I actually did a filling with the gari and stuffed and rolled it in the fresh sardines.
Oh my gosh. That sounds so good. So I know that you grew up cooking with your mother.
Yeah.
And what was she cooking when she was in the States?
She cooked a lot of Ghanaian dishes. And I think the idea was that both my parents were working and dinner was the one meal that kind of brought the whole family together. And I think particularly my dad missed, you know, traditional food. So it was always Ghanaian dishes that we had for dinner. And honestly, I think before I went to college, it was really my mother's birthday and Mother's Day that were only days off. And we literally ate Ghanaian dishes throughout our childhood. And she had ways of making modifications based on what she could and could not find. Mm-hmm.
So what could she find?
She could find... let's see. There were some of the ingredients that are similar to a lot of Latin American cuisine. So like we can find certain yams.
Uh-huh.
That time it was the 9th Avenue. There used to be a street with several shops. So and she's from northern part of Ghana. And so there's a particular yam that she can, you know, just by looking at it, she'll know it's from her, like her region.
Wow.
Of the country.
Wow.
And so it would be certain types of yams, plantain, of course, that we can get from a lot of shops even back then. Most of the spices she would have to make modifications for.
Is that, I was wondering if the peppers or chilies or...
We started using a lot of the jalapenos in place of sort of the scotch and the scotch bonnets in place of the traditional one. The traditional one is smaller than our scotch bonnets.
Uh-huh.
And it's called pakwashito. And it's actually a small, really fragrant green pepper.
Hmm.
So there's this chili sauce, but she would buy the ingredients and actually make it herself.
Did she have the time? I'm just amazed.
That's actually how I ended up helping, being like her helper.
Uh-huh.
But, she's a lawyer and she would work and come home and then we would do dinner together.
And, do you have siblings?
Yes. Sister and a brother.
Oh, right.
And I'm the eldest.
And where are your siblings now?
My sister is in New York and my brother, he's currently in California. Uh-huh. Yeah. So
you're the one who made the big journey back.
Yes,
the oldest. Yeah. I wonder, how do your parents feel about that?
I think it's mixed. I mean, clearly they would love it if I was closer.
Yeah.
But I think at a certain point, I'm also the one that's carrying the legacy of the family back in Ghana. So I think it's a mixed bag. You know, I think part of why I went back was feeling a sense of responsibility as the eldest to have that link with my relatives and with the country. My sister and brother are... pretty much, you know, not going to move to Ghana.
Yeah.
So, having, you know, family Thanksgivings here in the U.S., it was like there were five of us for Christmas, five of us for... And meanwhile, my parents, I mean, my mother, there were eight of them in her family.
Wow.
And
so you have a lot of... So when you went back to Ghana, your whole family's there then?
Yeah, yeah. My mom...
And they just didn't leave?
No. Let's see. I have two of my aunts from my mother's side who... one is in Nigeria and the other one lives in the UK, and but a majority of them stayed. Yeah, and same with my dad. So he's got his side of the family that's also still there. And it's a big extended family.
So when you were going to school in Westchester, what was that like?
Let's see. It was interesting. I mean, like, I think for my siblings and myself, it kind of brought us closer together because we were a little different than everybody else. So we were quite close. Our focus really, as I said, was education.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I kind of had a one mission.
That was it.
Mind.
Then you got yourself to Dartmouth.
Yeah, I think from the time I was about 5 years old, I said I wanted to be a doctor, and my parents took it very seriously.
Uh-huh. And what does that mean? You got...
When I was in high school, I was... I was in the sort of math science track.
Uh-huh.
And I think I did calculus. I think my sophomore, my junior year, so I, like my senior year, there were no math classes to take. I took an optional science class where I was making anesthesia and aspirins. And I, after school, I would actually go to a medical center where we were doing research on E. coli. And that's, I mean, literally what I did after school when I wasn't playing volleyball or soccer. I just loved being in the lab and I loved creating things and just playing around.
That seems like, I mean, one doesn't want to mix E. coli and food, but that notion of, you know, creation, understanding how things go together.
Yeah. And my first love in the kitchen was actually was baking. Uh-huh. So it makes perfect sense, actually, in terms of the idea of formulas and understanding how things, the chemical reactions that happen, basically.
Right. Yeah. And I can see easily how that would lead you to chocolate, which we'll get to a little bit later.
Yeah.
But you ended up going to work at the UN.
Yeah, so I finished, I did, after I fell out of love with my pre-med program.
Yeah. What made you fall out of love? Because that is
I think it was physics.
Just one course.
Yeah, it was physics. I ended up, I realized that I wanted to do something that supported society, but it wasn't necessarily medicine.
Mm-hmm.
One of the electives that I took while I was at Dartmouth was geography, human geography. And I really just took to that class and ended up being a geography major, along with environmental studies. And
I imagine that has become more and more interesting, right? I mean, people's fate is so tied to geography.
And it was amazing because I didn't really understand it. But I think when I go back now and look at what I've done, I just recently had my reunion at Dartmouth a couple months ago.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the question was, who's actually used their degree?
And
I was like, I think I have. Actually, I think I qualify. So that was... what I majored in. And at the beginning, I thought I was going to do Peace Corps. And then later on, I actually decided that I wanted to join the United Nations. And I ended up doing work around that. And
so what did you do?
My first job was actually an admin assistant with UN peacekeeping. I was a civilian, but I was working in Kosovo. That was my...
Oh my God.
I remember one of my friends who, you know, did consulting. He was like, you know, Selassie, you don't have to take the first paying job that comes along. And I was like, this is an amazing opportunity. I'm going to go.
Wow.
So I ended up being part of the first peacekeeping mission that had a gender unit. And I was actually part of the gender team.
And what does a gender team do?
Basically, they'd had, let's see if I get everything right. But peacekeeping had not been engaging women in the peace process for many years. And so that was one of the findings that came out. And I think Kofi Annan was actually Secretary General at the time. And I forget the Security Council resolution, but it just said that women must now be involved and engaged in when we look at peacekeeping and peace building. And so that was the very first one. And at the time, I was an intern.
Can we just pause and say, that's amazing to have women not involved in the peacekeeping?
Yeah, and especially when you look at history, a lot of the peacemakers are women. So usually it's the women that are like, we're tired of our kids being killed. And they're the ones that start to, I mean, if you look at the stories of Liberia, they're the ones that were sitting in this field every day waiting for the war to end. You know, so the same, similar stories when you look at the Balkans. But so it was the first one. And at the time I was an intern with UNIFEM. It was a perfect match, so I ended up going.
And what's UNIFEM?
Sorry, United Nations. This is before UN Women. It's a United Nations Fund for Women.
Okay.
And so it was an opportunity for me to actually learn more about the work of the UN and how to better support women. So by the time they started this thing, it was a perfect match. I was someone who'd been working with UNIFEM. They needed someone who's an admin assistant, and, you know, it was right after I'd finished school, so great matchup. So I did that, and then I also worked on minority protection. There were some groups within, at the time, Kosovo that were being sort of targeted, and so we did programming to find ways to support them. So that was kind of my first job, I guess.
Those were really intense. I mean, I feel like it's just as intense as, you know, curing cancer or making vaccines.
It's interesting, and I always say somebody has to do it, but for me, I didn't see the danger in it. It's kind of interesting because I never really saw the danger in it. For me, it was more of a mission of, I'm here to be part of the solution.
Uh-huh.
In retrospect,
how do you block out the danger?
I think it actually might have more to do with how my family left Ghana. So I think for me, I see it as people in a situation that need support in their country. So I actually didn't make the connection until later on in life that that's probably what's driven me to feel that I'm helping people, because I have come from a situation where, you know, help was needed, or that I understand being taken out of your home country or being displaced in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, very displaced.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know it makes you much more empathetic.
Exactly.
So but does it make the job harder because you have feelings, you know what they're going through? It's hard.
For me, I didn't really.
No.
No.
Good for you. I'm sure it makes you much more effective.
I kind of stay focused on the task, but yeah.
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 And then you did a lot of work in Africa.
Yeah. So I think my I'll tell you the story about, you know, sleeping in a fridge, but whatever.
Did you really sleep in a fridge? I hope the door was off.
I had my foot in the door. So when I was in Kosovo, I got there in November. I did one winter, and then that was a horrible winter. There was no electricity.
Oh my goodness.
The heating system was based on electricity, so we didn't have heat.
Oh.
And it got to the point where the water was frozen in the building, because it was an apartment building, so all the pipes are frozen with water.
Oh, my goodness.
And when you go to bed, it would just sort of, you know, you take a... I actually would be fully clothed, put on extra socks, and then a couple extra duvets, and then I would take a bottle of water in the sleeping bag with me, and it was kind of like every morning it was like, do I want to brush my teeth, wash my face, or clean my armpits with the water?
You got one choice.
Yeah, well, you got two. The next day you would like rotate. But there was one night I got home and it was just so cold, and I actually opened my fridge and noticed that my butter was actually getting soft. And I realized that when there's no electricity, your fridge is actually an insulator. It's insulating against the heat, but it's actually insulating what's inside. So when it's off, it actually keeps things warm. So I actually took the butter out like the day before, not like thinking like, why is it soft? And then when I came home that the next night, I was a little desperate and I realized like, that's a warm place.
Oh, no.
So I actually was waiting for a friend to pick me up because I was just like, I'm gonna, I just couldn't stay in the apartment. So I actually just kind of took the racks out and kind of backed in for a couple of minutes to just sort of like warm up a bit.
Nothing like a place that's so cold that the refrigerator's warmer.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. And did
so after that, I was like, I'm going to Africa. It was like no more like, you know, winters. I was like, I'm focused and we're going to Africa. That's where we're going to work.
And so what did you do in Africa?
The first place I worked, I did some work in Angola. I did human rights work with the peacekeeping mission there. And after that, I moved to Liberia, where I started working with UNICEF. And that was supporting children that had been associated with the armed forces and armed groups.
And
it was child protection work. And that's where, I mean, for me, those are some of the best times for me in terms of like feeling like I was really supporting and helping others. And kind of directly seeing, you know, the impact of my work. I mean, there was one boy that I remember we'd managed to, he was always like this, he was a little special, like in the interim care center. So after they'd been removed from the forces, he was just a kid that was a little different than the others and would always hug me whenever I would see him and stuff. And so I would go there on Fridays just to sort of get a connection with the kids to talk to them about what they wanted in their future. So as we were doing programming, I could really integrate that into that work. And so a few months after he'd been reunified, I was on my way. There was a World AIDS Day parade, and I was supposed to speak with the young people about it. And all of a sudden, someone comes running up to me and like jumps on me, and I fall to the ground. And it's this kid who's like, he lives in this internally displaced camp, and he was reunified with his family. And he wanted me to meet his mother and his brother. Like, it was just the most wonderful moment for me.
Incredible.
And so it was moments like that I held on to in terms of my work over the years, because with that, it was just like everything is worth it, you know?
Yeah. But I guess the day-to-day is just grueling.
Yeah.
So the switch to... I know that when you were in Senegal, you... with a couple of also foodie friends.
Yes, yeah.
You did.
One of the things in terms of like moving around a lot is you end up sometimes doing things the easy way, which is going to a grocery store, and most of these grocery stores have imported products, which ends up being a bit expensive, but then you also kind of feel like, you know, what's out here, what's available locally. And so I started a cooking club with some friends, and I tend to be a little competitive sometimes. So we had a criteria. So every month we would meet and we would choose, I think, two fruits, two vegetables, a starch, and an herb that we would all have to cook with in some way, either first a starter, main course, or dessert. And the criteria for voting, we would all eat, and then we would all kind of fill out a form. And we would select for which course we thought was the best. I mean, who prepared the best of which course. And it was on... visual, you know, like presentation, taste, use of the ingredients, and creativity. And the three of us kept winning, and people started getting annoyed and stopped showing up, you know. So the three of us eventually decided to go to the CIA Pro Chef program.
Right.
And so we did that. And after we finished, we passed, you know, we did the exam and everything after the course. We went back to work, and the other two were also
working.
Yeah.
That's so hard to imagine, you know, helping these kids in these difficult situations. And then cooking, like, they seem so disparate.
Well, I think for me, one of the outlets that I had was, it was a creative outlet for me.
Yeah.
I'd always loved food. So, I mean, even when I was in college, I used to, like, cater small, you know, events for friends and stuff like that. And the other two were very much similar in that way. And what I thought was fun about it was we traveled a lot, but it was a moment that everyone could kind of bring people together for something new and different. And we ended up doing food that you would not see in Senegal. And Senegal is actually an amazing food scene.
Absolutely incredible.
So, I mean, to go there and try to do something food related that is, you know, that is different, you know, you have to push yourself to the next level. So we started doing that, fantastic, amazing ingredients. The three of us actually were all working in regional offices and did a lot of travel, but we still, it was kind of an extreme hobby.
Like some people might fly for a hobby. You've got putting together these competitive meals. And when you thought about having a career shift, because I'm obsessed with the notion of, you know, changes in career, how did you think about changing from the UN or peacekeeping or all these different things you were doing and traveling so much and then choosing something else to do? Like, what was there a moment that you made that decision?
Yeah.
Or?
I think there were probably maybe at least two moments in there, but I ended up doing a lot of work with regional offices with UNICEF. So I spent time in Nairobi covering East and Southern Africa. And so I covered and traveled to countries from Eritrea to Ethiopia, Madagascar, you know, all the way down to South Africa, Botswana. And then at the same time, when I was based in Senegal, covered West and Central Africa. I never got to Mauritania, but going all the way to Central African Republic. So, like, all the way through. And so I ate really well. And I had an amazing time. And I had two reflections. Was one, I felt really lucky that I got to experience and taste food that a lot of people would never have.
Mm-hmm.
The second aspect of it was I also at the same time found myself defending African food a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of my colleagues who didn't understand some of the food we were eating. And I kind of felt like it's really good. And I had this one moment where
I love that. It's good. Don't you people understand?
Well, I mean, for me,
like, do you think that they were just being Euro judgy or?
I think that a couple things, some of the places we were, for example, some of the places the one moment that I really was like, you know what, I'm going to go to culinary school and I'm going to show them, was when I was in Central African Republic and my friends and I managed to get them to go on holiday with me. Well, they work there and I went to visit them and I told them that we were going to go on holiday and see the gorillas and go into sort of the rainforest and check it out. So it took us 2 days to drive. And we got to this lodge and met this young French student who's doing his, like, 1 year off, I think, before or after university or before university. And it's his father's friend who owns this lodge. And, you know, he just was going off about how horrible African food was. And I was like, how many countries have you been to? And he's in this literally a village in the middle of nowhere. And Central African Republic is actually, I think, at the time it was the second from the bottom in terms of human development index, but was in the middle of a raging, it wasn't raging at the time. It was in the middle of a lot of civil turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
So food systems had broken down and a lot of the traditional systems have broken down. So what he was seeing was not what it's supposed to be. And I kind of always reference when I went to Cuba, it was, you see these amazing, gorgeous buildings.
Mm-hmm.
They're not in their prime, but you know where they were.
Right.
It's kind of like Sophie Loren. You know, like, you know, she's gorgeous. She's still gorgeous, but she was, you know, something
even
else
more
before.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. So I kind of feel like a lot of these countries, there has been a breakdown in food systems. Families have broken apart. People have stopped cooking for different reasons, and people are making do with what they have. So it's not always the way we look at you know, heritage cuisine in that kind of way. So I could always kind of see where it's coming from, and knowing that, you know, like when I was in Cuba, like a lot of the food is still being affected by, was at the time when I went, affected by, you know, the...
well, scarcity, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly.
And embargoes. And,
exactly. Yeah. So for me, I can see the bones of the cuisine, mm-hmm. but also because the bones of the cuisine has always been what I held on to for culture. In our family. So you know, in terms of my family, my Eve is not very great, mm-hmm. but I can understand it, but I know the food more. You know, like yeah. the food is the one thing that even, you know, my brother who was younger when we came over, he doesn't understand Eve, but let me tell you, when he was in university and started losing weight, my mom started preparing the food, sending it into thermoses, and doing FedEx next day delivery to him.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
What was in that thermos?
It's a dish called palava sauce.
And what's that?
It's usually, traditionally it's made with cocoyam leaves or taro leaves, but my mom makes it with spinach. And she uses makes it with lemon.
That's the substitution.
Yeah.
Right? You need to be able to substitute a few of these things.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just going to ask you one more question, then mm-hmm. we're going to take a quick break and we'll return and talk all about the foods of Africa that you celebrate and prepare for guests all over the world, really, mm-hmm. which is so extraordinary.
Okay.
But you seem very mission driven, and it seems that the mission is very clear if you're helping with UNICEF.
Yeah.
Was it... an internal conversation mm-hmm. with yourself, you know, how important can food be if I'm sort of saving,
yeah.
I'm saving lives, I'm reuniting families,
yeah.
I'm doing this really big work that is very clear, and yet what you've chosen to do, it's also very big work, but it's a very different thing.
I think... at the last, you know, when I was in Senegal, I did a lot of work around, we did a lot of preparedness and disaster risk reduction. And we did support also to malnutrition or nutrition crisis, food insecurity. And what I realized is there's a lot of stuff that's actually available if we use it right. And
stuff by stuff, you mean?
What I mean is, okay, so for example, the questions around malnutrition. Okay, every 3 to 5 years, there is a crisis in the Sahel, and there is drought or drought-like conditions, and the food stocks go down, and it affects a lot of people, and disproportionately children, mm-hmm. right? And one of the main... Well, one of the treatments, actually, that we use is something called Plumpy Nut, and it's a fortified, basically, peanut butter.
Uh-huh.
And...
it has a good name.
Yes,
Plumpy
I know.
Nut.
Yeah.
Is Plumpy actually a nut, or is that like Jif? Is
it... it's literally, it's peanut butter that's been fortified, and the company that makes it is in... it's a French company that has the patent for it.
Fascinating. Okay.
And for me, it was one of these questions where, you know, at the time, there were, I think there's now one factory in West Africa, but there were not when the first crisis hit. And so here we are bringing in tons of peanut butter, I mean, Plumpy Nut. And it's actually a medical treatment because it's fortified to the point where one carton of this saves a child's life.
Wow. I mean,
so it's really important stuff. But I'm looking at it and saying, we have the world's, I mean, how many countries in West Africa are growing peanuts as their staple crop, and it's everywhere, but we're not even able to use it to support. So for me, it's kind of like, if we have peanuts available mm-hmm. Locally, what are we not doing right with nutrition locally mm-hmm. So that we don't get to the situation where we're in need of that? What are the crops that we should be growing? We know that there's drought coming, there's mm-hmm. climate change coming. What are we going to do? What should we be eating? What should we be adapting to actually find ways? Because I do believe that a lot of the solutions are in the continent for mm-hmm. the problems in the continent. So I started asking myself questions about this and looking at our food systems in West Africa particularly, and realized that actually behavior change can come through beautiful, sexy food. Actually, and also rethinking and reevaluating what we're eating and what we should be wanting to eat. I don't know if that makes sense.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, if you can make anything desirable, I feel like it's the paddlefish dilemma. You know, you rename it all of a sudden. It's very appealing.
Yeah.
Marketing of food is its own animal. But so is what you're saying that, though from the outside, like me, it might look to me mm-hmm. as though you're having dinner parties and you're highlighting the foods of Africa. Mm-hmm. You have your deeper purpose there is back to education, the thing that has motivated you mm-hmm. forever, but to educate the people on what's possible, like on some bigger
scale. I think that I started with what I could do, which is, okay, let's make it attractive. Mm-hmm. So there's an element of it is, you know, people are drawn to attractive food. They're going to engage with it. So part of it is at my dinners, I tell the story of where the food comes from. I'm also supporting local producers. And I'm able to tell the story both to the diners and luckily, you know, to the outside world in terms of what I'm trying to do. I'm hoping to now scale it to the point where there's two components. One is the component of how do we push for larger behavior change, because not everyone can come to my dinners and not everyone can afford my dinners. And we can talk a little bit more also about why and the cost of food and, you know, why is food expensive and what can be done about it. But for now, you know, I would say that not everyone can come to my table. I would like more people to, but not everyone can come to the table. But how do I also get the average Ghanaian to, or, you know, wherever, to start thinking about what they eat in terms of what it's doing for you and what the climate can and what the ground, the soil can support. So, for example, in Ghana right now, it has become a very big rice culture. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the rice is actually coming from Asia. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the local rice farmers are not able to sell their rice. And so when you look at all of these, but at the same time, I think there are projects now coming into Ghana where they're going to be planting jasmine and basmati rice, which is what the market wants. Mm-hmm. But my question is, what does the soil want? Because if you're planting basmati and jasmine, it's going to take a lot more water. And we know that already there's the cycles have changed, the rain patterns have changed. And we've got millet and sorghum, which do really well with poor water and poor soil content. And we also have things like Bambara groundnuts, which are kind of, they look like chickpeas that help to fix the soil. So, you know, should we not be saying this is what works for our soil and let's see how to get young people, particularly the children, to get into eating these foods so that we can actually support the country? I mean, one of the things I realized when I moved back was a lot of my age mates and stuff were, we left in 81, my family left Ghana in 1981, and a lot of my classmates, I should say age mates, who were in boarding school were telling me stories how in 1983 they went to boarding school. When they were in boarding school, they would go to the canteen and they would be told, you know, come back for dinner later. And come back for dinner later was because they had sent someone out to go and buy food. And just the historic on that was, you know, there was the military coup d'etat and there was no foreign exchange coming into Ghana. Hmm. And there's no foreign exchange means that we weren't able to buy the foodstuffs that we were buying from outside. So all of a sudden, this has created a food security issue. And it's actually not, there was a lean year that year, but it was not 100% because of the rainfall. Mm-hmm. It was actually probably more because we were not able to grow food to feed ourselves. And I say, how do you build a nation when you don't eat and produce what you grow? So when you look at a country like Ghana, a lot of our farmers are growing pineapples, mangoes, and things that, you know, are going to be sold to make international exchange to buy what we need. And that puts us also in, my second degree was in international security, focusing on security policy. What kind of deals will you sign if you know that this is what you need to do?
Yeah, it's so complex, right? Yeah. And, you know, many countries confronted, I was talking with Jose Andreas, who is obviously mm-hmm. deeply involved in food security around the world, and mm-hmm. he talks about unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it might seem like it's a really great thing to be growing mangoes for export and you have the cash, but if you're not feeding yourself, or the rice situation, mm-hmm. you know, the idea that you can grow millet and sorghum.
But, I mean, we have, let's see, I think it was $60 million dollars was spent on importation of onions in 2016 in Ghana, And if you think about that, how many people can you employ if you were able to
grow your onions? Yeah.
So it's actually also stimulating the economy in a whole new way. Yeah. So, I mean, the food is just, it's what keeps everything.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back and we're going to talk about some of the really beautiful, incredible foods of Africa that Selassie has cooked with and is trying to bring to new audiences. So stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Pop M, a unique shop teeming with vibrant colors and awash in pop art, located in Littleton, New Hampshire. Its alternative cafe marries healthy and fresh with luscious and decadent treats. At Pop M, indie brands and local artists mingle, bringing quality and hot-off-the-press style. Follow Pop M at popm.nh. This episode is also brought to you by the Institute of Culinary Education, a career cooking school with culinary arts, pastry and baking arts, restaurant and culinary management, and hospitality management programs, plus more than 1,500 recreational food and beverage classes a year. Earn a diploma in 6 to 12 months at the New York or LA campus. Land an externship in the top cities for restaurants and hospitality, and find your culinary voice. Learn more at ice.edu.
Dana, and we're back with Speaking Broadly, and my guest today is Selassie Atadika.
Atadika.
Atadika. I'm never going to get it right. Atadika. And we've been talking for the last little bit about her extraordinary life to date, which involves, trying to get warm in a refrigerator in Kosovo and also helping children, people around the world, and also being cognizant of, food insecurity and how to address it in your own country. Mm-hmm. So you're addressing very, very large questions, mm-hmm. but you're also doing what you can do, which I think is the most important thing, right? Because if you tried to solve the problem yeah. of the trade imbalance, you probably could do that, frankly. but I like that, you've started with dinner parties. They can bring people together, but you yeah. can really have a conversation.
Yeah.
And then you can share the conversation, and that conversation can grow and grow and grow.
Yeah.
So I'd love you to tell me, what do you serve at a typical...
My nomadic
dinner. Is there a typical dinner for you? Or
I change every dinner. It's like a new menu or a mix of what I've done before. So the ideas behind the nomadic dinner is we change location every time.
So wait, when are you going to come to America and do it?
I'm actually planning on spending the next few months around here.
You are?
Yeah.
Oh my God, we're so lucky. we're going to have to talk about that more later.
Okay.
But I didn't know you were going to stay.
Yeah, well, not full time, but I want to spend a chunk of time. And one of the things I did, I think about a month ago, I did a guest lecture at the CIA at Hyde Park. And I was talking about, African cuisine. And I asked the room of students how many of them had an interaction with African food. And out of a group of, 60 students, two raised their hand, and both of them was linked to family reasons. And I just said to myself, wow, how are we going to move and get people to taste our food and understand our cuisine and be excited about it if, we only have two people in a crowd? So I think it just made me realize that I think, it would be interesting and exciting to spend a bit more time here to actually get people to understand and know more about what I'm doing. So the normal, I do a nomadic dinner, and I started doing them about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago in Ghana. We try to change locations, and each time we change the theme, and I send out the menu, and people can just join, and they get their ticket online. They get the location about 2 days before, and it's usually one long table or two long tables, and everyone just kind of comes and joins in and make new friends, basically. The dinners are themed, And depending on what I'm feeling or what's going on, I change the theme. So sometimes if it's, I think this year, the beginning of this year, we did superfoods, African superfoods, because it was, you know, the beginning of the year, everyone's trying to eat healthy. So it was highlighting some of the superfoods that we have in the continent.
I'm dying to know what they are.
So, yeah.
You're talking about... a singer whose song Africa
yes.
mentions so many foods. So I listened
yeah.
to that. I'm trying
yes.
to, you know, pick up all of the references to all of the foods. But I think that fufu is the the closest I've gotten.
Yes.
So I can't wait to hear more.
What I try to do is, because I also find that if I say Ghana, there are people in Accra, which is the capital, that may not know some of the dishes from the northern part of the country. At the same time, there are people in Accra who are both internationals and Ghanaians who may not know what is eaten in Nigeria or, you know, another African country. So I also try to bring in themes that are around the continents, either, you know, it's sub-regional cuisine. Sometimes it'll be something from the American South. I did one which was Afro-Brazilian, because in Ghana we actually had a group of, we call them in Ghana Toban people, but they are freed slaves from Brazil that came back and they settled in Accra. And there's actually an area and a community where their descendants live.
Hmm.
And so we did a dinner in that home, one of their homes. And it's interesting because there are certain ingredients from West Africa that went to Brazil and
uh-huh.
some of the Brazilian ingredients and items that came back. So, for example, there's one dish that you'll find throughout most of West Africa. It's cowpeas
mm-hmm.
that are soaked, that you blend and you make into a fritter.
Mm-hmm.
And in the northern part of Ghana, we call it kose.
Mm-hmm.
In the southern part of Ghana, it's called akara. Nigeria, it's called akara. It's called akara also in Senegal.
Mm-hmm.
And in Brazil, it's called akaraje.
Hmm.
So it's, you know, they have a slightly different way of doing it that involves like stuffing it with shrimp
mm-hmm.
that we don't traditionally do. And so the idea is just to have a dinner where we have a menu that has a theme where we can have a conversation around sort of food ways.
Mm-hmm.
The last one I did was, it was Wakanda themed because I was
uh-huh.
shocked that... In Black Panther, there was actually no real food scene. There was one tiny little scene.
That is so surprising.
You know, I mean, they thought about everything, about
yeah.
what that would look
world
like.
Would
but there was nothing about food. And I was like, really? And the interesting thing is that particularly in West Africa, everything revolves around food. And a lot of phrases revolve around food. So, for example... In slang, sort of, if you think someone's cheating you,
mm-hmm.
you'll say you're chopping my money, which is chopping means eating.
Oh.
So there's so many phrases and things that we say that revolves around food that I was really, you know, like, really? They decided
how
to leave that alone.
That? Yeah.
So for that dinner, for example, you know, I had, I decided to push the envelope a little bit. And there's a dish from Nigeria that uses goat head. It's a goat head stew,
mm-hmm.
basically. And one of the things I really like about African cuisine is that we really don't waste much.
Yes.
And I just think it's an ingenious usage of parts, you know, really nose-to-tail cooking. So I did the dish, and I actually, you know, and the other link is that in a lot of... traditional ceremonies and big celebrations, there's always, usually in the traditional sense, there's like an animal that is sort of like offered. So for example, there's a wedding, you know, if it's a big wedding, you kill the cow and,
right.
you know, or a goat, depending on, you know, what you have. And so I think that element of celebration, royalty and everything kind of made sense for me. So that was that was our first course that the guests got to walk in and see, like, you know, there's like a goat head, a skull.
That's very dramatic.
So, I mean, for me, it was also a conversation about using everything. So we definitely make sure we have options for vegetarians
mm-hmm.
and everyone is welcome. So it's, you know, we manage the different dietary preferences. But I usually in my meal try to make sure that the animal protein is less
uh-huh.
Because I do think that when we look at feeding as many people as possible,
mm-hmm.
we need to really be careful about how much animal protein we're using, because for example, we don't in Ghana have, you know, regenerative beef.
Right.
So, you know, you kind of have to balance it out and look at alternative, you know, I use a lot of beans in my cooking, and bean leaves are a great source of protein. And, you know, so we mix it up, but I try to look at telling a story around what is available and what we need to appreciate more. So there are certain dishes, for example, like the peanut, again, going back to the peanut.
The mighty peanut.
Yes, but I also find it like the humble peanut, you know? It's a lot of people see it as a bar snack. And so I decided to make it into a dessert. And I did my first iteration of it when I was in Senegal. And I did a trio of peanut-related desserts. Mm. And it's now evolved into a dessert. Okay, in Ghana, there's a street food called Kofi Brookman. Kofi is like a very traditional name, kind of like John Doe. So like everyone's named Kofi. Like, we have day names, and Kofi is a very popular one. Kofi Annan would be one.
Yes.
So Kofi Brookman is basically it's a slang for street food, which is roasted peanuts and plantain, you can buy on the roadside. And usually it's not expensive, so regardless of your budget, any broke man, anybody can afford to buy it. So it's a very, like, you know, when you're out and about and, you know, you need a snack, it's a perfect balance. You've got the carbohydrates, you've got your protein and everything ready to go. So I was inspired by that, and I turned it into a dish that has several layers, so different textures of one plantain when it's black. You know, it's been used in a cake that I learned from my time in Liberia. There's another version of it, which is just, you know, simple green plantain chips. I've taken the peanut. I've done one version, which is a mousse using a traditional recipe from Ghana, which has chili, ginger, sugar mixed in with the peanuts. And it's this amazing, like, spiced, I turn it into a mousse.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, we have crushed groundnuts, you know, and then I add a little bit of herbs to it and citrus to lighten it up. And I call it Kofi Richmond. So, you know, it's finding ways to take things that are sort of peanut and plantain, which is really simple, humble food, but elevating it to a space where it can be on a table for any and everyone in a different way to experience it. And I think I want to find ways to add pride and dignity to our cuisine, you know.
So in the work that you did before the cooking, you were working very much with your mind.
Uh-huh.
And now you're working very much, I mean, it's very physical.
Yeah.
All the cooking for people, and you have to clean up, and you have to prep, and you have to shop.
Yeah.
Is there something gratifying about that?
Absolutely. I think it's one of these things where I always, halfway through the event, I'm like, why am I doing this? And then by the time I wake up the next morning, I am like, okay, the next dinner, we're going to have this, you know. Like right now, I'm actually thinking through my menu for the next nomadic dinner, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, my inspiration right now is agroecology. So it's like, how do I bring some of those principles into the menu and the dishes that I'm going to serve?
So are you going to be cooking while you're in New York or this area?
So I will be heading back very soon.
Yeah.
But I do plan to spend a few months mostly in the New York area, and I would love to actually cook. You know, I also have a lot of high school friends that are like, hey, we want to taste your food, and college
friends.
So,
oh my gosh, I can see quite a series.
Yeah.
And then what's the response been? You know, people come to your dinner and does it open their eyes? Have they, you know, what is that like?
I would say for a lot of the Ghanaians, I love this moment where it's like, this is our food. And and our food can be like this.
Yeah.
I know we had a high level, you know, event, and I think it was, you know, people from government were like, we didn't know our food could look like this.
Mm.
And we've had also expatriates who live in Ghana who, some of them are, you know, ambassadors, et cetera, who have lived in the country for a little while, but they have not experienced food in this way. And so for them, they get excited about it. And people are like, hey, we have visitors coming from our home country, and we would love to show them this expression of Ghanaian cuisine. But we also have, you know, people who see a lot of street food. And I like to play around with street food and elevate it, because I do think that there is... it's kind of like that soul food that you know you want and you're missing. And being part of my thesis is also when you get to a certain level in society, you stop eating certain things because you for example, sugarcane. I love sugarcane, but I will not buy street sugarcane anymore. I know too much about food safety to like just buy it off the woman on the street, you know? And so I would never, so when am I going to, you know, unless you go home and like you literally buy the sugarcane and strip it down, which is actually a very hard outside and takes time, you're probably not going to eat sugarcane very often. So I try to find certain things that I know that people may not, because, you know, maybe they're just not going to engage with anymore or as much as they want to. I try to have some of those dishes. And so I've had a lot of people who've like maybe lived in Ghana for a few years. I've heard about this dish so much, but I never felt comfortable to try it until today.
Sure.
So that's been my reaction. And I think also, you know, when I've done stuff here with Ghanaian dishes, you know, I think people just don't know what it is. So it's like once they try it, they like it.
Well,
they're surprised.
Like, it also seems like you've done quite a bit to take the fundamentals and elevate them. Another thing you've elevated is the chocolates. I've seen your chocolates.
Yeah.
They're so beautiful.
Thank you.
Is that a business you're running alongside? Do you do it just when you're able? And can you just describe for everyone who's listening those chocolates and how you put them together and
sure.
the African elements inside
yeah,
of them?
Yeah, so my brother-in-law, when I was moving back, was like, hey, you know, Ghana is so famous for chocolates, but there's not, like, amazing chocolate coming out of Ghana. And, you know, I always try to find ways to add value to local ingredients, so I took that on as a challenge. And basically, my chocolates are an expression of my love to the continent. I just think that there's so many amazing spices and fruits and just flavors that people are not familiar with. And I think that chocolate is an easy vehicle to get people to, I mean, everyone loves, pretty much everybody loves chocolate, but it's just, it's an easy vehicle to send something new in. And I think whenever you're trying to get someone to try something new, you give them something they know with something they don't know. And all of a sudden, it becomes easy to accept. And so the flavors tend to be a little on the savory side. So with my sort of more cooking background, the idea was, how do I take all these amazing spices and flavors that exist in the continent and put them in chocolate to allow people to experience something they'd never have?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm not going to... The idea is not to give you a chocolate that you would get in France.
Right.
I'm giving you an expression of where it comes from and to tell the African story through chocolate or through chocolate flavors or flavors in chocolate. They're all named after women. And I think that women are the custodian in most cultures of our culinary sort of heritage. And I wanted to pay homage to them through that. And we have different collections. Some that are spiced. So I always try to cover the continent. So with every collection, I try to have flavors that would represent the north of Africa, East Africa, Southern Africa, and West Africa. So that's basically what I'm doing with the chocolates. We're still trying to roll them out. I can be a bit of a temperamental artist when it comes to things. So I want to not... right now, there's no preservatives in them. So, you know, it makes it difficult to kind of sell them outside. So I'm now having my personal kind of dilemma, you know, how long should they keep? And how, you know, because I want more people to try them.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of interest. And so I'm hoping to actually figure out how to get them into the U.S. in the next, you know, maybe by early next year.
I feel like you could have someone make them with you in the U.S.
Yeah.
It's great. Well, we can talk about that later.
Okay, yeah.
I just think that it would be great for people to be able to experience those flavors.
Yeah.
And you were talking about educating, you know, people here as well as educating people back home. And chocolate just seems like, what didn't talk about an easy education.
Yeah. You know? I mean, there's one flavor that I did. We did a dinner at the Beard House, and it was the truffles we give them at the end of the dinner. And I think, you know, when you give something like that to foodies, they want to know what's in it.
Of course.
And this one, it's a blend of 5 spices that are indigenous to West Africa. So they were like, oh, is it rosemary? And I'm like, no. Is it cinnamon? And I was like, no. And so, like, I was like, you've actually never tasted the spice before. And that just, like, blows everybody's mind. Like, what do you mean? I'm such a foodie. I don't know.
Everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Oh.
So, yeah.
I love that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine some of the base spices, not that blend, because I know it's your own blend, but the base spices probably are available here
yeah.
In a way that they wouldn't have been.
Yeah, I would say that, for example, if you're looking at the North African spices, you can definitely get those here. There's a lot of general flavorings that you can get locally. So, I mean, I would say that a lot of the savory side of our kitchen goes back to most traditional cuisines. What I mean by that is everyone did preservation, right? So there's a lot of smoking, drying, salting, fermentation that happened in everyone's kitchen. And those same things apply to African cuisine. So when you go to West Africa, we smoke, dry, salt our fish. There's some fish that's fermented as well. And, you know, I think I always say everyone has a stinky food. So whether it's, you know, the stinky, funky cheese that you get in France, whether it's the kimchi that you get in Asia, you know, everybody has a fermented, funky food, and we're not used to everybody else's.
Yeah.
But I'm like, you know, I remember when I graduated undergrad, and one of my friends that was Korean, she, whenever we went anywhere, she would bring her kimchi.
Uh-huh.
And back then we were like, who brought the kimchi? You know, and now we're like, who's bringing the kimchi? You know, and that conversation has changed. And I think the same thing will happen, I think, for African cuisine. And I think people just need to, it'll take a little bit of time, but I think once people engage with it, they'll, you know, there are a lot of similarities and familiarities that.
So is there a woman who you've followed in the food world, like as you've gone on this journey, who you want to call out? I love paying it forward on this program. And is there someone who comes to mind?
In
the food industry.
Let's see. I mean, that's a hard question. I mean, there's a lot of women that I follow. I mean, one of the women who is a Ghanaian woman, and she's in her, I think she must be in her 70s now. She's kind of like the grandmother of Ghanaian cuisine. And she's someone who went into this when it was not cool, when it wasn't hip.
What's her name?
Barbara Baida.
Okay.
And so she has actually put together sort of a good reference document, because in Ghana it's hard to find, it's actually hard to find a lot of books written down with recipes. And so she's actually one of the people who spent time doing that. And it's a co-written book, and I'm trying to remember, her name is Fran. I'm trying to remember her last name, but the two of them did this book together, which I think for me is fantastic. And the beginnings, you know, she for me, she's someone that has started documenting and working on taking Ghanaian cuisine outside and pushing the envelope on that, and letting she's a catering school also in Ghana. And so for me, it's also someone who made it something that was a profession, you know, made it professional and made it something that people should strive towards, and not something that I think in the past before her, it was more of a vocation that you chose because you were not good in school.
Mm-hmm.
And so, or maybe not chosen, you were given. But so she was someone that was like, it's okay, you know, it's a profession, you know, you can make a living from it. So in terms of that, I think she's someone who I look up to in terms of that.
That is the wrap up to this show. I wanted to thank you so much for coming and joining me. If people want to follow you on your adventures and learn more about Madunu, if I pronounced that right, you know, how would they find you if they're...
Yeah, so we are, Madunu is that sort of the savory, it's a savory side of the business, and that is madunu.com is our website, and it's Madunu on Instagram as well as on Twitter. And for our chocolates, we have madunuchocolates.com and madunuchocolates on Instagram.
That's great. And you guys know where to find me, FW Scout. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram. Always love to hear from you. Love to hear feedback on this incredible show. And I look forward to having you join me next week. So have a great week, guys. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.